Joining us now is Dr. Mark Thornton. Mark is with the Mises Institute over in Auburn, Alabama, Mises.org. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Al. It's great to be back on the program here with you.
Well, I'm glad to have you. The Credit Managers Index came out today. Why should the average person listening to us now worry about what the Credit Managers Index had to say?
Well, I mean, everybody should know this, that, you know, credit is a driving factor in any economy. Basically, if credit is expanding and savings is expanding and businesses are investing, that means that there's an overall economic expansion and that entrepreneurs are expanding their businesses and hiring more workers, maybe having to hire more skilled workers. And so credit expansion normally is a very good thing for the economy, and credit contraction, of course, is a sign of economic decay and decline. And so if credit managers and their outlook is turning negative, then that's a problem for an economy, because it means a contraction in the economy and fewer jobs going forward.
Well, we got an official contraction in the first quarter, and if you start adding up all the reports we've gotten for the second quarter so far, it would point to a contraction, contracting quarters a recession makes. But I think they're going to jump through hoops to try, even if it's 0.1% again, at least on their first consensus estimate, try and avoid that recession tag. What do you think?
Well, I think that that's, you know, probably a good starting point, that they're going to try to prevent an official recession from kicking in, or at least to prevent the National Committee from considering an official recession at a time when, of course, Bernanke and Yellen and Obama, Congress is all saying that the economy has recovered, it's getting better, things are looking pretty good going forward, there's an expansion, so on and so forth, when in fact GDP numbers were bad, and they, of course, we revised twice in the negative direction. And then you have, you know, investment goods and investment and credit all contracting. The National Association of Credit Managers index fell to 56.1, which was unexpected. They were expecting it to increase from the 60 level, and instead it decreased. They felt that this drop was, quote, unexpected. You know, the other data releases are starting to show similar negative trends. So the economy is clearly not out of the woods yet, with the latest revision of the first quarter GDP, you know, some kind of shock, so that the economy has clearly contracted by far than more than originally reported. And then you look at durable goods orders, which were disappointing. There's clearly, according to the Credit Manager Association, there's clearly something amiss. And so even though consumer confidence numbers seem to be elevated and to recovered from the start of the recession, that level of enthusiasm has not been able to pull the economy forward. And you know, so the when you look inside this credit managers index, it's even more disturbing, as the economist from the Credit Manager Association indicates. In particular, one component of that index looks at new credit applications, and new credit applications actually increased and is now in the high zone for the first time since the recession began. However, he points out that the problem is that there's more credit rejections. So there's more applications, but the number or the percentage of rejections is also very high and up in the latest report. And so he points out that when there are more applicants and more rejections, that's a signal that more companies are in financial distress and, quote, are seeking credit in hopes that somebody will help them survive. So, again, I think that the data is finally starting to reveal to us that this recovery is a sham recovery, And that the consumer confidence and the confidence that's exposed in the stock market, there's really something amiss with all that stuff. There's really something that is not linked concretely to reality.
Mark, what do you say to people, though, that say that perhaps we're being overly negative and look at all these wonderful reports that we're getting out of the government, how great things are, even though now even the government's having a difficult time reporting things as quite as rosy as they were?
Well, Alan, I mean, I think the real issue here is that things are not normal, and people ought to know that, and I think a lot of people feel that. And things are not where they're supposed to be. There's no normality in the economy. There's no full employment, for example. There's a lot of issues with price inflation in the economy. We have very abnormal interest rates because of what the Federal Reserve is doing. We have a huge government debt. And yet you've got a stock market and, you know, people investing their money in the stock market at all time highs. So I think it's important to not say, well, we're just a few percentage points off of, you know, the target for GDP. And, you know, so don't worry about it. I think it's more important to, look at problems and make sure that everybody is aware of those problems so that they're not blindsided by the next stock market crash or the next surge in unemployment. That, you know, so consumers and the government have huge debts. Consumers generally are not experiencing increases in their take-home pay income. And so this is a very fragile situation, in my estimation, with high debt in both the private and public sectors, very high stock market values and bond values. If things should continue to worsen in the real economy, that could cause another one of these blowouts in the stock market. And so I think that it's more important to make people aware of the potential problems and the likely problems, actually, that that exist out there, rather than trying to paper over and make everybody feel that everything is rosy.
You know, the one thing that I found particularly, I don't know, I would say amusing, painful, the fourth quarter 2013 GDP. I mean, they basically revised that one away. I think they eked out a 0.1%. So now we had basically a flat, and I would argue a contracting fourth quarter, a contracting first quarter. Don't you think they stretched that 2013 fourth quarter to keep it from dipping into the red just so they didn't have to come out and say recession?
Well, I can tell you, I mean, it's certainly possible to massage the numbers and to make a small decline into a small increase. You know, they're manipulating, they're talking about everything in the economy. They're talking about all prices in the economy. They're talking about weighting all of these different types of goods, and income sources, and making estimates of various things. So it's certainly possible to massage the numbers to make things turn out right. But, you know, it's not just here in the United States. I was just reading economic reports, from Brazil, which is a large economy in South America, a big trading partner with the U.S. And across the board, economists in Brazil have been revising their estimates for the remainder of 2014 and 2015. And what they see is that there's increases in the expected interest rates in the economy. There's increases, small, but there's still increases in the rate of inflation. There's small decreases in the value of the Brazilian currency, and there's decreases in their estimates for GDP in Brazil. Same, very similar things are happening in the European economy as well. And then just yesterday, the Bank of International Settlements, issued a report. And this was, I found this very amazing. And we have a couple of economists, Peter Klein and David Howden, are reporting this on our blog this morning. The Bank of International Settlements has issued warnings that even though the economy has not completely recovered from the housing bubble and the financial crisis in 2008, that they're warning of asset bubbles around the global economy. And so they're looking at asset bubbles in terms of stocks, bonds, and real estate that are in bubble territory. And so, you know, this is the Bank of International Settlements is like the central bank for central banks. And they've been the organization that's done the most truth-telling relative to other central banks. And now they don't directly point the finger at their fellow central bankers, but I think that you and I know that that's really the source of these asset bubbles. And we just had a visitor here at the end of last week from Brazil, and he tells me of that there's a tremendous housing real estate bubble in Brazil, particularly in the high-rent residential districts of the major cities of Brazil, that real estate prices along the coast, especially along the beaches, has gone to, you know, all-time highs and greatly surpassed those all-time highs. And he told me this, you know, with a sense of doom and gloom. He's, you know, that the prices had gone up so high that very few people could afford to make new purchases. And he was also reading some of my papers on Mises.org about the housing bubble here in the U.S. But really, I've been getting reports of housing bubbles from all around the globe, from Norway, for example, and Canada. And so these things, we have sort of an epidemic of asset bubbles going on around the globe.
Yeah, I found that BIS report amusing in that it is the central bank, and the board of directors is comprised of the central banks who the BIS is pointing to indirectly and saying, we got asset bubbles. I mean, I wondered, what was that exercise all about? Because then Janet Yellen comes out and denies we have any bubbles, even though the organization she belongs to says we got them.
Yeah, well, they don't directly pin the blame on the central banks. You have to read the report carefully. You know, they say low interest rates are contributing to these asset bubbles, but of course, it's the central banks, it's the Federal Reserve, it's the Bank of Japan, it's the European Central Bank that are responsible for those low interest rates, because they're, you know, capping the interest rates that they make available to big banks at or near zero. And of course, that interest rate then gets transmitted throughout the economy, and people, investors, you know, the central banks call investors irrational. But it makes perfect sense that if you're making 0.3% interest on your money market funds, that you're going to move funds from those sources into other asset classes in order to earn some yield and to have some potential for some reward for savings. And so people, banks, financial institutions, hedge funds, and so forth, pension plans, insurance companies, they've all moved money from where they would traditionally hold their money, which is in safe sources like government bonds and corporate bonds, and they've moved those funds into riskier asset classes like stocks and junk bonds. And as a consequence of that, they've forced up the price of stocks, and they've forced up the price of junk bonds, driving the yield on junk bonds to all-time record lows. And so this is to me, it's a very transparent process. You've got the central banks, you know, pushing down interest rates, and then investors rotating out of those safe asset classes into higher yielding asset classes, but also riskier asset classes, and driving those asset bubbles ever higher, Alan.
Yeah, it just, that one blew me away. All right, I'm going to serve you up a softball, I think, because today is the day that the iPhone, the original iPhone, went on sale in 2007. And the mainstream economists, the Keynesians, always say that it's consumer consumption. It is spending that drives economic growth. And correct me if I'm wrong. You're the doctor. I'm the student. The Austrians say, no, it's production. And the creation of the iPhone, it going on sale today for the very first time, I think underscores the validity of the Austrian School of Economics. Would you agree?
What kind of connection are you making between the iPhone and the Austrian view?
That it was by the production of the iPhone that this new economic activity, the smartphone, was born. And now we have a whole industry and employees and raw materials and finished products and shipping and all that going around the production of a new product.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's very basic and straightforward. The Keynesians always claim, and you're going to hear this from Bernanke, Yellen, Krugman, and so on, that the consumer drives the economy, that consumer spending makes up 70% of spending in an economy, so that if the consumer starts spending more, that the economy will be moving forward, and then that will drag more people into the workforce and so on. And, you know, there'll be more investment and so on and so forth. And, of course, Austrians recognize that the purpose of any economic activity is consumption. That's our goal, is to consume. It's not to work. It's not to labor. It's not to toil. It's that our goal is to consume. However, we can only achieve consumption through production. So it's pivotal that production takes place. And, of course, you want that production to take place at a high level of sophistication. Basic production, trying to hunt and gather and plow fields and plant crops on your own, is very inefficient and doesn't produce very much. And so you need a sophisticated structure of production in order to produce large amounts of goods in an efficient manner. And so in order to produce, of course, you've got to do all of the groundwork for that to take place. So you have to save, you have to invest, you have to discover new technologies. And that's what the iPhone is all about, is discovering resources and putting them together in an incredibly efficient way using new technology and new recipes, really, in order to produce more goods, in order to pack in more consumer satisfaction per dollar into that product, and to do so in a very efficient way, you're really using the entire structure of production around the planet. And so you have dozens of different companies that are specializing in the production of very, very small ingredients or pieces that go into that iPhone. And so I think that there's more than 20 different countries that are providing parts based on the design that was produced here in the United States. So we design it in the U.S., parts from the U.S., parts from 20 or more different countries, all are sent to assembly plants in China, where they are assembled at a very, very low cost and then shipped back to the United States and around the world to consumers for the purpose of consumer satisfaction. So it's an incredibly intricate process that involves inputs from around the planet using very innovative technology from, you know, patents that belong to various companies, and all of those come together and then are marketed by the Apple company around the planet. So that's really something that is so complex, it's very difficult for anybody really to understand how complex all of that really was. Even Steve Jobs himself he sort of had a surface understanding of a lot of the technology that went into the design of that product. But if you were to actually try to visualize this process, it would really be beyond human comprehension to get a full sense of what's really going on there. But it's really the type of sophisticated economic performance that has produced a product, a new product, based on a lot of new technologies that has really created a revolution in human life.
So is that a good analogy for the difference between the Austrian and Keynesian views, this iPhone?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Consumers didn't dream up this product in the first place. This took a lot of entrepreneurship on the supply side. This took a lot of innovations. It took the build up to this process was decades, if not centuries long, to be able to get to that sophisticated level. 100 years ago, consumers had no idea that their activities could somehow generate this kind of process. We're not passive consumers, but we don't originate, these things from the consumption side. It's entrepreneurs who originate these things in order that they're trying to imagine what consumers want, and they take the risks of going down these innovative paths, taking risks. And, of course, those risks have to be rewarded. And that's why, in the end, this iPhone, which is produced, hundreds of billions of dollars of consumer satisfaction in the marketplace. That's why the market has rewarded or did reward Steve Jobs and the shareholders of Apple with profits and high stock prices. And so you've got to see this whole system as a self-regulating process that when the government stays out of it and allows this process of production and savings and entrepreneurship and innovation and profit and guided by profit and loss, it can produce revolutionary things in human existence that the government could never dream up any things like this and execute them in any shape whatsoever.
We're speaking with Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute, MISES.org. Keynesians think that creating this money is going to revive the economy, yet none of the money is going to the people. And if they're a consumption-based theory, why not print the money up and just give it to the people to go spend? Why is it all directed to the banks?
Well, it would probably have more of a noticeable effect or impact if the money was just printed up and distributed, a la the helicopter or, big checks and that sort of thing. It would have a sort of a reverse tail end effect in a positive way. It would, it'd restore the balance sheets of consumers and workers in a more direct fashion. But that's not the purpose, really, of the central bank. The central bank is the manager, the regulator of the large banks, basically, and banks in general. Their purpose, it's stated that their public purpose is to maintain full employment and to keep inflation low and to keep the value of the dollar stable. But, of course, since we've had a Federal Reserve, the economy has been much more unstable. The value of the dollar has dropped to virtually nothing. And we've had tremendously wide swings in unemployment. You can't forget that the Great Depression and the current economic crisis all occurred while the Federal Reserve was in place. So you've had these two enormous economic depressions. And you've also seen the value of the dollar depreciate by about 98% over the last 100 years, where if you look at the 100 years prior to the Federal Reserve, there was some short-term instability, but the long-term stability of the dollar was very, very stable. And so the real mandate of the Fed, based on, you know, what economic theory would tell us and based on actual economic history, is that the purpose of the Fed is to protect the big banks. And so they've flooded the market to try to stabilize the balance sheets of these big banks. And they might pull it off, but it's going to come with the negative effect that we've had this economic malaise, an economic recession over a period of many years. And as we started the program in the beginning, that things are far less rosy than they appeared or that we were led to believe at the beginning of the year. And so there's no sign, there's no clear sign that we've somehow gotten back to normal. We've gotten back to the point of economic growth being positive and normal, and that people's real income or take-home pay adjusted for inflation is somehow improving. That just isn't the case. And so when they say injecting money, helping the economy, or deficit spendings, programs such as that where the government spends money into the economy and borrows money and spends it into the economy, the Austrians say that those programs don't work, that they're not helpful, and that they are actually harmful and detrimental in the long run for the economy, and even in the short run. They're doing the exact opposite of what Austrians would suggest, and it's not working. The money printing, the deficit spending, the large national debt that we have, none of that's somehow pulled us out of the economy. And they talk about, escape velocity, that the economy is approaching escape velocity. Somehow we're going to be able to, pump enough money in, pump enough government spending in, and then the economy will leap forward on the basis of this consumption stimulation on the part of the government. Well, it's just not taking place. And the Austrian theory suggests that it wouldn't work in the manner that the Keynesians have always dreamed it would.
Yeah, just looking at these headlines, this one from a publication called The Globe and Mail, U.S. economy back on track, but first quarter was nasty. I mean, you love it. And then I got another one says, U.S., shrinking economy, trouble for Democrats. I mean, the spin just depends on their agenda, doesn't it?
Yeah, the mainstream media is really having a tough go of it. They either bought into the central bankers and the politicians, notion that you can just assume away the problems in the economy. I saw several talking heads on the weekend, news and interview programs, saying much the same thing, that, despite this awful GDP report, apparently they didn't see the BIS report or the National Credit Managers Association report, that somehow that the numbers were going to mysteriously turn around and turn not just positive, but very positive. And so, the more time goes on, and the more they try to extend this lie, from 2007, when Ben Bernanke was claiming he saw green shoots sprouting up in the economy, till today, I mean, it seems to me like the mainstream media is just barking the Federal Reserve story, the White House's story, and congressional stories about, economic recovery. It hasn't happened, Alan. And in the process, we've more than doubled our national debt. And national debt is the worst of all possible economic problems, in the sense that economies have only gotten into severe inflationary problems. That is, higher prices resulting from monetary inflation at very high rates, because they get backed into national debt problems. And so we've been going down this rosy path while in reality we've built up this huge long-term problem where the national debt by itself is over 100% of gross domestic product. And, of course, that doesn't include all of the unfunded liabilities like Medicare and Social Security, which really have not been addressed. I mean, in the only sense they've been addressed at all, you know, despite this should be Congress's number one job is looking at these unfunded future liabilities and making solutions to them. But the only thing that they've really done is pass the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. And, of course, as we've discussed on previous programs, that so-called solution is actually making things much worse.
You know, you sit there and look at health care, Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare, and then I've had recent experience with the cost of providing health care. There's no way that they're going to be able to afford this. And yet, what becomes of the people who need that which cannot be afforded? For example, on my mother had that stroke, and one of the treatments was that TPA, a compounded a drug. $20,000 for one treatment.
Yeah, well,
I still scratching my head over that one, but apparently that thing just goes in and liquefies anything that's bothering your system. Anything that's clogging your cardiovascular system up, that one will just go in there and blow it all out. But, I mean, that was just one person on one day. I mean, you multiply that over everybody having a stroke. I mean, it's unaffordable. But what do?
Well, we've got to realize that we've injected the federal government and all of its various programs, regulations, subsidies, privileges into every aspect of healthcare. The pharmaceutical companies get patents or monopoly grants that very often outlive their supposed time of expiration. And so they get these monopoly privileges, and they are extended beyond the traditional timeline for patents. And so the drugs are monopolies. The hospitals have monopolies. You can't compete with existing government hospitals unless they say it's okay. And then, of course, the doctors have a monopoly over treatment. And, you know, that extends to a lot of other areas. And so everything to do with human health care, traditional human health care, is government-subsidized, government-monopolized, government-controlled directly. And so naturally the prices are very high. And then, of course, they've infiltrated the whole consumer side with insurance, with subsidies to insurance, so that consumers never really face the price of a healthcare good or commodity or service. And so naturally this market is just completely, well, you can't even really call it a market really, but it's completely overwhelmed with government intervention. And so it's naturally, it's just a mess. But if you look at the marketplace that acts around human healthcare, and you look at things like plastic surgery, dentistry, or veterinary medicine, where these same monopoly powers and interventions have not been as significant. And what you find is tremendous services that, you know, I go into the dentist and get services, and it's you know, there's very little waiting. The services are prompt and courteous and effective. Same way with my veterinarian. Never have to wait in line, never have to, you know, wait a long time for appointments. The bills can be high, but they're not astronomical. And I've been told the same thing is true with plastic surgery, that, you know, you don't have to wait in line. You get prompt, effective, courteous service.
LASIK surgery, too.
What's that?
LASIK surgery is another one.
Yeah, LASIK surgery. I had that done. I called up one day, and they said, yeah, come on in after your lunch. and for an examination. I came there, got immediately into the technician, and then there was a second person, and then finally the surgeon came in and said, okay, this is your, you know, these are your options. And I said, okay, great. It sounds, you know, and it's fairly inexpensive. As a matter of fact, I think I got some kind of discount, and, you know, and I had it, the procedure done the very same day. And it was, turned out to be great. And, you know, that's just not the case with healthcare. You have to wait in line. Service tends to be very poor. And there's not a lot of controls, proper controls. For example, I've always wondered why doctors don't provide you with written instructions for what you're supposed to do after you leave the office. And I've seen in my case, in the case of many other people, where they forget about this, or they do the wrong thing, or they're at the wrong time, whatever it happens to be, there's not those specific instructions that would make the having of an appointment, the having of an exam, the writing of prescriptions and so forth, much more effective. And yet they just, you know, tell you a few things and send you on your way. And very often that leads to a lot of problems. Whereas if, you know, I take my dog or my cat into the vet, you know, I get very specific instructions. And if it's complicated, like if I have to do some kind of procedure, that I have written instructions with a number and name to call if I have any problems. But, you know, that would, so, but with human healthcare, that very rarely takes place. And I attribute all of that, all of that chaos in human healthcare, to the fact that the level of government intervention in healthcare is almost complete. It's almost the government taking control of every decision and every aspect of human healthcare. And if you don't have a good person, a good doctor, a good nurse with a good heart, you're in trouble.
Oh, I would agree with you on the government, because everything that I encountered during this experience, it all revolves around Medicare, what's handled, what's not. I mean, it's like, it's obviously the federal government's in the driver's seat, and we don't yet have the full rollout of Obamacare.
Yeah, and this is what, you know, they were talking about when they were discussing death panels. There's no specific death panel, but there's a lot of government bureaucracies that are making specific control decisions about payments and procedures that are going to be affecting people down the road, you know, that where you don't see a real true panel. You just are told what to do, what to pay, and what to expect.
We've been speaking with my friend Mark Thornton. Mark is with the Mises Institute over in Auburn, Alabama. The website is mises.org. Mark, it's good to be back in the saddle with you, buddy.
Thanks, Alan. Great show.
Hey, before I let you go, what type of pet do you take to the vet?
Right now, I've got four cats.
Gotcha. My daughter's a cat person. I'm a dog guy, but I like cats.
I love dogs.
All right, Mark. Good talking to you.